This is Beyond the Farm Gate, a show where we shine a light on great Australian stories in agriculture.
On the show, you'll hear from farmers who survive challenges like fire, flood and drought, people who run innovative and unique agribusinesses, and those who are balancing work and family in rural Australia.
You'll be inspired hearing their stories and pick up some insights along the way. I'm Beck Wren.
I'm Greg Kugel.
And I'm Zali Thomas.
Today, we're joined by Guy Webb, Global Agronomic Lead at Loam Bio. Loam Bio is at the centre of cutting-edge research and development, working at the intersection of agriculture, microbial science and climate. Loam originally started as a team of five in rural Australia over a decade ago and has now grown to a team of over 100 across four geographies. The R&D conducted by Loam Bio is valuable in learning how the global ag industry can be utilised to help combat climate change while also benefiting its farming partners. In today's episode, Guy will take us through the evolution of Loam Bio and their products and how these products are beneficial to farming systems. He'll also tell us about the future of Loam Bio and his predictions for the carbon industry in Aussie agriculture. Let's jump in. Guy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Beck. Lovely to be here.
So how did Loam Bio come to be?
Yeah, Beck, I guess it depends on how far back you want to go. We started in 2019 in earnest, but it's probably worth a little bit of a review of how we got to that point to start Loam Bio, why we're here, you and I talking. It's all to do with context, I guess, as most things are in the evolution of ideas and so on, and just a brief sort of flying overview of how we've ended up here through context. I grew up on a sheep and wheat farm northwest of Condobolin in some fairly marginal cropping area. So I left school when there was a big transition happening back in the 80s between grazing, moving slowly towards more cropping, and I was part of that. So my brother and I got on a couple of tractors and cleared up country. We bought a one-way plough and ploughed up the country and all these things to grow crops. If I look back now, we were incentivized to take carbon out of the landscape, basically. We cleared trees out of the way so we could grow crops, probably less strategic than we could have done. We did some things good and some things not so good, I think is the story of agriculture, really, across the world. And we didn't realise it at the time, but each time we ploughed, and quite deep one-way ploughing, we were losing carbon out of the soil and losing the ability of that soil to hang on to moisture and things like that. So I came home when there was a massive tax on wool at the time, a 25% floor price tax, and the interest on borrowed money was somewhere around about the same percentage. So welcome to agriculture, Guy. You know, it's probably some of the hardest times in agricultural history almost through those era. But I saw a lot of dust storms and land degradation through that time, and I just had this feeling that there must be a better way all the time the 10 years I was working on the farm. And it really led me to a point that I wanted to actually go and study this in a lot more detail. So I went to ANU and studied soil science, and that led me through an agronomic career. I realised quite early that carbon was such an easy metric to measure. The amount of soil carbon in soils is an easy measurement to make to see whether you're doing good things for soil health or maybe degrading soil health, because of the simple function that more carbon in your soil means it can hold more water, the water infiltration into the soil is better, and the drainage through the soil is better. So really dry seasons, really wet seasons, and all of the above, more carbon in your soils makes it easier to manage those soils. So it becomes a very simple but very accurate measure of soil health. So I became very focused on studying soil carbon and how we might move that metric in cropping systems particularly, because that was my context. And it became a very frustrating journey, but I set up a business on the back of it, a consulting business, and a bunch of other farmers throughout New South Wales and down into Victoria and a couple out in Western Australia as well were quite like-minded in the fact that the lights had come on for them as well, that if we can increase soil carbon, then we can increase our yields and our crop. But not only that, we can be more resilient in these fluctuating seasons of wet and dry cycles that Australia has always been and will continue to be, no doubt, maybe more so. So it became, I had a tight bunch of growers that I'd be consulting to around how we might build soil carbon. And it was in that context that I ended up in 2012 sitting at a carbon conference in Dubbo. and the very last speaker on a three-day event. So everyone was, you know, it's a pretty unenviable spot to be speaking at the last speaker after 3 days. Everyone was just busting to get out of there. And I'm sitting there with this context in my mind that how do we build soil carbon? Because this is just hard work. We're not doing all that well at it. It's not easy. It's not economical, not cheap to do. All the major things to build soil carbon are quite costly in a cropping program. Anyway, this old retiring professor got up on stage and presented this work that he'd been doing where they isolated a particular type of fungi he termed dark septate endophyte, which I'd never heard that term up till then, and they'd inoculated onto Denmark subclover, and they'd got this ridiculous increase in soil carbon measured really accurately, a 17% increase in 14 weeks. I clearly remember it today. And I remember sitting there with that context going, oh my goodness, like this is like what I've been looking for. Could it be as simple as that? That like we inoculate rhizobium for nitrogen, we take nitrogen out of the air using the bacterial inoculant on roots. Could it be as easy as that, that we can get the right kind of microorganism onto the roots of plants and take carbon out of the air and put it into the root zone in the soil at enough quantity to be meaningful? And old Peter McGee's data suggested that's exactly what he had done. So I got on his ear after that and had a good long chat to him over dinner that evening, and we set ourselves to do some research together. He made me up some fungal inoculum and I took it out to fields, canola, wheat, barley, cotton, variety of crops, and did some replicator strip trials and so on with his inoculum. And we were getting reflective results of what they actually got at Sydney Uni. So I got completely consumed, I guess is the word, by the idea. By that stage, I was also doing some more research into climate change. So being from quite a conservative country environment, I was climate skeptic in my youth. But when I went to uni and actually started studying it in earnest and seeing the physical evidence and the scientific evidence, it really got me interested in the subject to do more education on it. So I enrolled for a couple of courses through the University of Queensland and another one through Macquarie University over the years, and been upskilling myself in that space ever since. And became, it takes 5 minutes to actually for the penny to drop, that if you can take the carbon out of the air where we don't want it and put it in the soil where we do want it, and some back of the envelope numbers around the scale of agriculture, we quickly realised that, hey, agriculture is the largest carbon sink, terrestrial carbon sink on the planet, only second to the ocean, and farmers control that sink. How about we give them a tool that they can sequester carbon at scale and at speed and easy and economical, then you have a scalable and adoptable way for not just climate change mitigation, but the remediation of soil health throughout agriculture. So as I said, I became really obsessed with the idea that this could provide the answer. All I needed was some funding to go and do some research. So obviously with a mission like that, you attract really good people. So first on board was a Trangie farmer, Mick Wettenhall, that committed time and effort and motivation and passion to the project, and we went about trying to fundraise it. We set up an organisation called Soil Sequest 2031, which is a not-for-profit that still exists today. And over time, there's a whole other backstory there, how that evolved. We knocked on every door that we could possibly imagine to try to get funding. We did end up having a funding breakthrough, and we were actually offered a lot more money if we turned it into a for-profit where there was a commercial path to market, which in the end made a lot of sense. Not only get the scale of investment, because there'll be a return on investment compared to philanthropy, and to be a commercial path to market, which every agricultural product has. So we set up Loan Bio in 2019 to do just that. And all the way through, there's been this sort of balance between delusion and audacious goals. And I don't think in reflection there's much difference between delusion and audacity. It's just a continuum. You go from being delusional to audacious as things consolidate. And that's where Loan Bio is today. It's attracted some amazing people. Not too long after Mick Wettenhall came on board, another farmer from Bowden Gate, just half an hour west of me where I am now, near Forbes, Tegan Nock, came on board. Guy Hudson came on board, who's been playing in the climate space for his career and bought a lot of investment savvy. And then we just built the team out from there and got an amazing range of some of the world's best scientists on the job at the moment, something like 30 PhDs and 70 scientists actually working on this problem. Now we've expanded out to the US, Canada and Brazil, and hopefully in the future further afield.
What an amazing story. I think that that's interesting how long the journey was for you in terms of getting to this stage that you are at now. So what has been your favourite element along this journey?
There's many, Beck, and it's hard to pick a favourite, but I guess what I like is that we can actually incentivise good practice in agriculture. And in my years as an agronomist, I would walk out across the paddock to do a recommendation on how is this soil, how can we grow better crops, how can we manage the weeds and pests and diseases. And I've got an armory with me, right? So I've got all these different chemicals and fertilisers that I can prescribe to fix all the problems that are in front of me as an agronomist. And that was my job, to do just that, but with the bent of trying to think about more deeply soil health. So you'd run your finger down a soil test and to the soil organic carbon reading and you go, there's not much I can do about that. So the thrill for me is now I can run my finger down a soil test and go, oh, they've only got 0.8% organic carbon. Hey, I've got an answer for that. We can actually fix that now. And not only fix it, but as time has gone by, you know, the carbon market has evolved to what we see there today. And there's a huge pile of money available for ACCU generation, Australian Carbon Credit Unit, as a fungible item, as a commercial tradable thing. And farmers can grow that as a crop in their soil in a stacked way, like physically stacked one enterprise, the grain enterprise, over the soil carbon enterprise, which is under the crop, and one's got a positive feedback loop into the other. Now it's on the books, it's on the balance sheet that carbon is important. Growing it as a crop, it has financial meaning in my business, and it's a benchmark and a tool that I can use to benchmark how well my soil is going. And if we look at it through those lens, then we're actually being incentivized, or incentivizing the industry towards storing carbon in our soil financially. I think it's just human nature, isn't it, Beck? Like, if we incentivize good practice, then good practice will happen. But if we disincentivize good practice, even people with the best meaning find it hard to do the best practice because it's not incentivized. So that's been the big flip. This is a real key in the lock technology that unlocks that ability for farmers to put carbon on their balance sheet.
Absolutely, I do agree. Incentivizing good practice is the way forward for every industry, not just ag. So I think that that's going to be really great to see flourish in the future. So now we know how Loam Bio started, but let's talk about what you're doing now. So what kind of products do you currently have available?
Yep, so we're working through them one by one almost, it seems. We've got what they call a stage gate process in the science. So we start off looking for a bunch of fungi, which we did in 2019. We got a very large library of the right kinds of fungi, and then we run them through genetic mapping, so metagenomics program, to look at, basically read the genes like a book, and to tell us, has this fungus got the right characteristics to be able to store carbon and give a plant growth response? Then they go into pot trials, and then the ones that win out of pot trials go into small plot trials, and the ones that go from small win there go into strip trials through air seeders on off strips. And then finally, if that all works and it's nice and reliable carbon build with a bit of a yield bump, then that gets commercialised. So we started off with canola, funny enough, not known to be a fungal host. In particular, mycorrhizae fungi don't particularly like canola, but dark septate fungi do. So funny enough, canola was our first crop. And then we've bought barley online, and then we've been working really hard for wheat, because wheat's the biggest crop globally. There's something like 750 million hectares of wheat grown globally every year. So it's the biggest crop by far. There's wheat, then there's daylight, and then there's the rest of the crops that we grow. And it's been frustrating because we just haven't been able to crack wheat until last year's data came through. And we actually finally found an endophyte that suited wheat really well. And we've got some really good numbers on wheat. So we're almost completed that rotation. That's the whole idea, that the complete, so each year the farmer has the ability to inoculate the full rotation. So wheat, barley, canola, we have pulse in the wings, hopefully be ready fairly soon. So for the range of pulses, so we'll have that full cropping rotation, and then out into pastures in the pipelines as well, if there's a pasture lay, so that every year we can inoculate with the particular fungus isolate that we've chosen that's the best at that particular job for that plant. to sequester the most amount of carbon, and that way we can reliably build carbon in the soil. So we're building soil health, soil resilience, at the same time as generating a second income on that hectare of land by merit of soil carbon credits.
Amazing. And how long, I mean, obviously it'll differ dependent on what crop you're testing this on, but how long does that process take? Like, how long has it taken for canola or barley?
Yeah, so it's all how much time, effort, personnel and money you throw at a problem is how fast it takes to solve it. It's been at light speed development, to be quite honest, in agricultural terms. Like, a product like this would usually take 10 or 15 years to develop. We've done canola in 2, wheat in 4 and barley in 3. So that's really light speed. And we've done that purposefully. We recognise the urgency of the mission at hand. So we want to pull down as much carbon as fast as we can globally. One of the early mantras was that we want to orchestrate the largest carbon drawdown in human history. And because of the size of the problem of getting enough carbon out of the atmosphere as fast as we can. So everything is set at ways that we can fast track our research, still maintain the scientific integrity, but fast track it through to being in the farmer's hands. And the way we've done that is through not just being really hard on employing the best scientists that we can globally. So we fish in the global pool, if you like, and we actively chase the best scientists. But we also do a lot of collaboration with organisations that are already good at a particular part of the science that we need. And we'll go and do some sort of agreement, those organisations, universities and so on, that have a piece of the puzzle that we need. Might take us years to actually get to their stage, so we plug these universities in where we need them. And through that collaboration, that's been able to fast-track the development of these products to market.
That's great. Well, it's good that you could fast-track it, and it's collaboration with different companies is always good too. Collaboration is key, really, isn't it? So you've sort of gone into it initially, but how is carbon actually being pulled from the atmosphere with these products?
It's really quite simple and really elegant how the process happens. And a simple way to explain it is you've got a plant growing in the ground, right? And every day that plant is photosynthesizing. So that means that it's taking water, sunlight, and carbon dioxide as the feed-in fuels, if you like. Through the magic of photosynthesis, the plant makes sugars. So you've gone from a gas, which is carbon dioxide, and turned it into a liquid, which is the when you get a plant and you squeeze your thumb and finger along the stem, liquid comes out, right? And you can taste that and it tastes sweet. That's plants making sugar. So plants will do that every day, obviously, and they dump some of that sugar load into the soil. So it dribbles out of the roots to basically to lubricate the roots down through as they're trying to punch their way through the soil. They also liberate carbon out in the soil to feed microbes, beneficial microbes that are good for that plant. So that there's an active kind of communication system going with the soil with plant root exudates. So we just take advantage of that basically. So what would normally happen is those carbon exudates, and it can be as much as 25 to 30% of the daily photosynthate net gain that the plant does, can actually dribble out into the soil. But what usually happens is the bacteria, which dominates cropping systems, will chew that carbon up very quickly, and through respiration, like you and I, breathe out carbon dioxide, they turn that carbohydrate back into carbon dioxide quite quickly, and it diffuses up through the soil and basically leaks back into the atmosphere. Very normal situation. That's what they call the carbon cycle. So that's pretty normal for that to happen. But what we do is come in and inoculate very intently on a particular fungus that's very good at taking that carbon that's dribbling out the roots. And instead of letting it leak back into the atmosphere, they use it to make a lot of fungal compounds. One of them is something most people will be familiar with called melanin. And melanin is, if you look at your forearm and see a freckle, that's the freckle is melanin. That's the coloration in nature. Angus cattle are full of melanin because they're dark colored and so on. So they make this compound called melanin. It happens that melanin is very stable in the soil. And the way the fungi sets that melanin down into the soil, they'll put it into deposits called microaggregates, so little clumps of soil. The fungi will find their way in there and deposit melanin there. In those kind of structures that's safe for decades to hundreds of years. And they'll also, if you imagine a fungi hyphae growing through the soil, if you like a little root, but they're microscopic, They're like a pipe that's full of melanin. They manufacture lots and lots of this stuff derived from the plant. And sometimes they'll smear it across a mineral surface. And this is in layman's terms, I guess, and it's called sorbing. And the melanin will sorb to the clay mineral surface. And it's like glue. It's like using Tarzan's grip, if you like. It's stuck there on the mineral surface for centuries to millennia. And we've been able to test this through radioactive tagging of carbon dioxide, which is our first peer-reviewed paper that actually came out last week, actually, through Western Sydney Uni. We've been able to show that a process they call carbon mapping. And you can map that carbon from carbon dioxide molecule down through the plant, down through the roots, out through the fungus, and out into the soil, and where that final fate of that carbon has ended up, and what sort of carbon we can do by a process called fractionation, which I won't go into now, but it tells us where the carbon is and how long the carbon will live, will stay there, reside in the soil. And it turns out these fungi do just that. They're not only stabilising the carbon and trapping that carbon flow that's going in the soil, but they're turning it into these long-term deposits of carbon. But, of course, that's exactly what the carbon market wants. When you're buying an ACCU, you don't want to buy carbon that's in there today but gone tomorrow. It's worthless to you. You're trying to buy an offset. You're trying to buy that process, that service that the farmer's providing of taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it somewhere for a long period of time, taking it out of action, right? And that's what we find is the market is highly responsive to the science part of it that we can tell them about the longevity of the carbon that is in these long-term deposits, and hence we can charge more for that sort of carbon, which is great news for farmers, and that's what we want. We want the economic signal dialed up to 11, that there's money in the carbon market and good money, and that's where we get adoption and scaling, deliver this to the ag community.
How cool. What an incredible process. Plants do some really cool things.
It's absolutely amazing. Yeah, such a simple and, as I say, a really elegant solution. It's taking advantage of a natural process that happens in nature, but we're just orchestrating it to happen in the right place at the right time in our agricultural soils.
Yeah, amazing. So you literally just touched on it a little bit there, and we've also talked obviously about how increasing soil carbon is beneficial for farmers and farming enterprises. So how can farmers leverage this product to benefit their farming enterprise in terms of carbon credits and et cetera?
Yeah, so it's a really good question, Beck, and I think it's we're at the pivot point now of the industry coming to an understanding of what this new opportunity looks like, and it is definitely an opportunity for growers. The impediment is just understanding at the moment of getting your head around this. It's perceived as being complex and murky, and obviously it's new. But when you pull back the curtains and have a really good look at it, it's a really stable market. It's an evolving and growing market, and it's a very highly monetized market, and no different to growing any other enterprise on the farm. You're basically growing a crop. This one's called carbon. There's a carbon market. People will buy that from you, and you can use that as an enterprise on your balance sheet. Only this enterprise is slightly different, is that carbon that you store in the soil doesn't go off the farm. You actually own that. You're getting, I've done quite a lot of farmer presentations, particularly last year. We did heaps and heaps of them, and it came really apparent to me that people didn't perhaps understand clearly what they were actually selling. So I often said to people that we all understand what a bale of wool looks like, right? And we know why we're actually growing that bale of wool, because you make socks and jumpers out of it and people keep warm. That's really obvious why that market exists. Same with a ton of wheat. We make it into bread. People eat bread, stay alive. So they're really clear markets usually in agriculture. We're producing primary produce for society. With carbon, you're getting paid for a social good, for social service of actually removing carbon from the atmosphere and storing it in long-term stores away from the atmosphere. That's what you're getting paid for. That's the fungible item. And that's represented as an ACCU, Australian Carbon Credit Unit. So it represents one tonne of carbon dioxide that you've taken out of the atmosphere. So I always ask farmers at these farm talks, does anyone know what a tonne of carbon dioxide actually looks like? And everyone's going, well, no, when you come to think of it, got no idea. And I was the same until I had to get the Googleator out and find out what does a ton of carbon dioxide kind of shape and size, because it's a colourless, odourless gas, right? So it's pretty hard to point at it and say, there it is, because you can't see it, can't smell it. But it turns out, if you imagine a hot air balloon, or I often say you look outside and look at a great big box tree, it's about the size of that is a carbon dioxide. And if you were to suck all that hot air balloon worth of carbon dioxide into the soil and turn it into soil organic carbon through the plant, through the fungi, it turns out it's about 272 kilos per hectare for every tonne of carbon dioxide that you take out. So if you want to visualise that, it's about a quarter of a 1,000-litre shuttle, you know, those IBCs that we get fertiliser and chemical in. It's about a quarter of one of them full of soil organic carbon spread out over a hectare, and that means you've taken a full tonne of carbon dioxide out of the air and put it in your soils. So now we've got a way of imagining what we're actually doing, but you're not getting paid for the carbon per se in your soil. You get to keep that, and you're not getting paid for the carbon dioxide because it comes for free out of the atmosphere. They're not charging us for that. You're getting paid for the process of turning one into the other. So it's the best thing going because you get paid for the service, but you get to keep the actual produce that you're making, which is the soil carbon, which in turn makes your primary enterprise even better. So your grain enterprise can only improve whatever you're putting carbon into the soil of which you're getting paid for. So it literally is the best news story in agriculture that I've ever seen. And the dollars are, you know, really attractive. The only impediment, I guess, is that people have to sign up for a 25-year period, which all of a sudden when you mention that, the heels go in the ground and people go, oh, my goodness, you know, 25 years, that's a life sentence. You know, why would I ever do that? But if you flip that narrative back on its head and actually look at it in the clear light of day, and I often use this analogy, if you look at a wool shed and say, right, we're going to build a wool shed here, I'm going to spend a fair bit of money on it and make it the best wool shed in the district, for example, I want the farmer to guarantee me that you're not going to burn that wool shed down within 25 years. And the farmer would go, what are you talking about? Like, I'm not going to burn my wool shed down. It's a valuable piece of infrastructure on my farm. I want to be there for 100 years. And he said, well, that's right. That's the same as soil carbon. It's a physical infrastructure, although this one's underground in your soil. That's an infrastructure that helps your water holding capacity, your water infiltration, your drainage, nitrogen, it hangs on to nitrogen, it makes phosphorus more available in your soil. All these things that we're aiming to do with our soils to grow better crops, soil carbon helps with. Why would you ever want to get rid of it out of your soil? It's no different to your wool shed. You don't want to burn it down. You want to keep it there. And the 25-year permanence period of a government-sanctioned project, an ERF project, just basically is a warranty to the market to say this carbon will be in the ground for 25 years. And that allows us to jack up the price of the ACCU, which makes the whole thing work. And if we don't have the 25-year permanence, the market goes, oh, well, you haven't guaranteed that it's going to be there for long. So we're stacking that 25-year permanence with some of our science to show the carbon we're actually storing in the ground by the fungi is a lot more permanent. And then we can satisfy that market desire for long-term carbon. But unfortunately, the 25 years, you have actually got to think about it a little bit more deeply and come to see that's actually a good thing. The 25 years is a good thing for the market.
It's an investment into the enterprise, isn't it? And thank you for explaining carbon in more of like a real life sense, because I certainly, until you told me, certainly had no idea how to picture it, because it's like you are getting paid for the service, but knowing what you're actually taking out is also very helpful.
It's such an important thing, Beck, too, isn't it? And I used to often sort of say to growers, it's pretty funny if you look at it, that we're going to the market saying, hey, guess what? There's this new industry where we take this invisible gas. You can't smell it and can't see it, right? But it's there, just trust me. And we put it through the plant, through this magic process using a fungi that, sorry, you can't actually see that because it's microscopic as well. But if you've got a microscope, you could probably see it. And then we're storing carbon in the soil. It takes a few years before you'll be able to see the colour change in your soil, but yeah, it'll happen. And then once we produce an ACCU, there's some people in a faraway land that will pay lots of money for that. And people go, yeah, this sounds like you're what now? So I can understand farmers being sceptical initially until they, like I say, pull back the curtains and have a really good look at what is happening. And you know, some of the figures that are coming out on the size of the prize, like it's $2.6 trillion, I read the other day, of committed money globally from all the big organisations around the planet that have made very, very public commitments to buying carbon credits to offset their emissions and so on and so forth. It's a massive pool of money available, and there's not very many technologies that can actually sequester carbon. There's no technology that can sequester carbon as fast as agriculture and on the scale of agriculture. So it puts farmers in the box seat to actually participate in this market and be the strongest players there.
Yeah, amazing. That probably segues well into my next question of where do you hope to see growth for Loam Bio in the future?
The ambition is to have, and again, an audacious, maybe delusional ambition, is to, definitely not delusional, it's definitely in the audacious compartment now though, but we want it in the hands of every farmer everywhere globally for every major crop so that we can have carbon sequestration happening whenever a farmer plants a seed. That can be a carbon sequestration event that takes place. And that's the sort of scale we need. To get up into gigaton, which is billions of tonnes of carbon taken out of the atmosphere and stored in the soil, there's 1.5 billion hectares of cropping lands in the soil if you include some of the marginal areas right through to the good areas. So if we were to store 2 ACCUs, for example, over all that area, you're at about 3 gigaton. So we've got to pull on every lever we can to actually get up to those kind of that scale that we need to get to in order to make any kind of difference to the challenge that is climate change.
And sort of on that, what do you believe is needed within Australian ag in particular to encourage uptake of products such as this one?
Pushing forward with the science is a really big one. They say, farmers are slow adopters. I think that is so untrue. I think there's lots of evidence to show that farmers adopt at speed, at scale, and we've all seen it happen. And it's based on the reality of things, basically, that can be proved out through economics and science. And that's what we agreed on early as an organisation, that we need to get horsepower, financial horsepower, to do the science properly so that we can come to the scientific fraternity and come to the agricultural industry with a pile of science to prove out definitively that we can do what we're saying we're going to do. So farmers like to see that confidence, that surety that, this is a real thing, the numbers are real, and if I use the product on my farm, that what they're saying will come to fruition. So that transparency around that, and that's something we try to do every day in our conversations with farmers, is to really lift up the hood on our science. We've had quite a few open days at Orange at our laboratory and talking to our scientists, walking through all our data sets and that. We've engaged lots of agronomists on that front as well, so that we educate some agronomists around what Loam is actually doing scientifically. So there's that side of it. And then there's the education on the markets side of it, so growers can have a really clear understanding of what the enterprise opportunity actually is. So we look at that in depth as well. So the not-for-profit Soil Sequest, for example, I chair, still going strong. Last 18 months, we built Course Growing Soil Carbon 101, and we've just launched that nationally, which goes into all that. So what is this carbon space? So the idea is you start the course not knowing too much about carbon. By the time you finish the course, you go, okay, I can actually make some financial decisions now because I actually understand it. So that was an industry-wide collaboration of a whole heap of organisations that helped us build that, and with a specific outcome to try to upskill the whole industry, like I say, pull back the curtain so people can actually have a look at how this thing works. So education is obviously the next big thing. And then we've got some actual projects going. This is our second year of doing real ERF projects out in the landscape across a wide range of geographies. And when we get to our first coring ground to actually validate how many carbon credits these farmers have made and actually commercialise those carbon credits, I think that's when the gates will really open up, where farmers will smell money on the wind, that there is actually money to be made in this enterprise and it's landing out there in the landscape. I think that's where we'll see. What I'd like to see, Beck, is this to become just an industry norm, that why wouldn't you be in a carbon project? We've got a technology to allow it to happen now. I want a stacked enterprise on my farm that feeds into my soil health. There's no reason why I wouldn't do it. I'm making good money out of it and it's really easy to do. I mean, that's the other big breakthrough, is that we can put the fungus on the seed very easily, no change to any other practice. The farmer's worked out how to grow the crop, how they want to grow it. We just come in and say, well, just inoculate with this fungus, business as usual, and we'll be storing carbon.
Amazing. So, in terms of Loam Bio's future research, is there anything planned Obviously, you've got canola, barley, and now wheat. Have you guys got another crop in mind, or have you got a few on the go?
Yeah, Beck, there's a few coming through. So we're just picking on the scale crops to start with. What are the biggest crops around the world? So obviously, we've got to get pulse in the rotation, lupins and vetch and chickies and fava beans and so on, the whole gamut of pulses and legumes, some of the grazing pasture species, your medics and clovers and lucerne and so on in the pipeline. Then if we go overseas, I just got back from the Midwest in the States and having a look at their corn soybean rotation. It's a massive area of just corn soybean. If they're not doing corn and soybean, they're doing soybean and corn. That's a nice simple rotation, but there's a massive opportunity to now pull down a lot of carbon in that really big scale there. Down in Brazil, they grow 47% of the world's soybeans. So we've got a lot of research happening in soybeans and corn down there as well. And obviously up in Canada, lots of canola growing up in Canada. So we're working on those fronts. And then, we'll slowly expand into other geographies as deemed by scale.
Amazing. That sounds really exciting. Lots on the horizon for you guys then.
Yeah, a lot of work to do yet, that's for sure.
Beautiful. All right, so now it's time for our quickfire round. So I've got a few questions that I'm going to ask you in rapid succession. There are two rules. The first one, you have to keep your answers to a maximum of one sentence. And secondly, you have to answer with the first thing that comes to your mind.
Oh, that sounds challenging. I don't know whether I'm ready for this, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay, number one, what is the best lesson you have learned from a mistake, stuff up, or a failure?
That mistakes are meant to be there to inform you.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
I'd like to be able to fly.
What's one piece of advice you have for anyone wanting to enter the industry?
Keep an open mind.
What phrase or cliche do you live by?
Oh, that's a good one. Good, better, best, never let it rest. When your good is better, make your better best.
Oh, that's a good one. I've never heard that one before. I'll keep that one in mind. And finally, when you're out on the farm, what brand of work boots do you wear?
Blunnies.
Perfect. All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Guy. I've really enjoyed our discussion.
Good on you, Beck. Thanks for putting up with me.
No worries. And where should people go if they want to learn more about getting involved with Loan Bio?
Yeah, we've built a pretty good website. There's lots of resources and that, with more resources planned. All our R&D will end up on that website soon as well. So that's just loanbio.com. Easy to remember.
Perfect. We'll link that in the show notes.
Great.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Farm Gate, a podcast by Rural Bank where we shine a light on great Australian stories in agriculture.
Rural Bank supports the agribusiness community by providing financial services, knowledge and leadership for Australian farmers to grow. For more information, including regular analysis and reports, head to the website ruralbank.com.au.
This show was produced with strategy and production support from Wavelength Creative. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Beyond the Farm Gate, be sure to subscribe to or follow the show in your podcast app. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. I'm Zali Thomas.
I'm Greg Cookle.
And I'm Beck Wren. And we'll see you in the next episode of Beyond the Farm Gate.